Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is professional sports bettor Rufus Peabody. Rufus Peabody, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Glad you're here. How did you get started in sports betting or other gambling stuff?
So I kind of just happened into this. There was no sort of intentionality at all. I've always been into the number side of sports. Growing up, I think I learned to read a baseball box score before I could even read. And, you know, I actually wanted to be a sports journalist when I was going into college. But I ended up, I realized that I liked the analytical side of it more than anything. So rather than just reporting on what happened, like why it happened, for example, in college basketball, maybe this guy, you know, a team was able to penetrate and kick out and get open 3-point looks or something. And so when I wrote articles for the school newspaper, a lot of it was sort of analytic, I don't want to say analytics driven, but sort of trying to analyze what happened. And so I ended up reading an article on ESPN.com my junior year of college by Gene Wojciechowski about this company called Las Vegas Sports Consultants. And he was embedded with this company for Selection Sunday before the NCAA basketball tournament. And it just seemed like the coolest job in the world, like these odds makers that set lines for these sports books. And I was like, I want to do that. And so I called, I found a phone number for this company. I called, I wanted to talk to the head honcho there, Kenny White. And they said like, call back 3 weeks later on Sunday at 3 PM and he'll be able to talk to you then. And of course I called back then and they're like, oh, he's not available right now, but this other time. They kept putting me off, but eventually I got through to him and talked my way into an internship out here after my junior year of college. The whole Tim Donaghy thing hit at that time. Tim Donaghy was the NBA referee that bet on games he officiated. And surprisingly to me, I was just an economics major who had taken some econometrics courses. Surprisingly to me, I had more of a stats background than anybody else in the office. And so it fell on me to sort of try to statistically break down this guy, Tim Donaghy, the line moves in his games. And so I was able to actually find some really interesting stuff. Las Vegas Sports Consultants offered me a job after college, and I did my senior thesis on psychological inefficiencies in the baseball betting market. So I developed a baseball betting model, and then I was working for LVSC for a year and refining my models, and soon realized I could do better betting than actually working on the odds making side.
And how many years ago was that?
This was 10 years ago. Well, I moved to Vegas in 2008, so I guess almost 11 years ago now.
So you're approximately 30-ish.
33.
Uh-huh. Good. You still get asked for ID when you go in the casinos for age purposes?
not in Las Vegas anymore.
All right. So you mentioned econometrics. What other kind of math background do you have?
So I took some statistical courses, but nobody would call me a mathematician or anything. I'm not really a theory guy as much as I am an application guy. I think one of the most useful classes I took in college was this. It was, I guess, technically a graduate level course, but it was sort of a statistical methods course where I learned about for social scientists. So it went into like cluster analysis, like principal components analysis, all these different methods, but with a, you know, the view is towards application rather than like proving it. So I figure for me, you know, I don't need to be able to write a proof of a particular method, but I just need to intuitively understand it and how to apply it.
And you must have a lot of programming background as well, right?
So I'm sort of a self-taught programmer. I'm not great at it. I'm a hack programmer. It's not pretty, but it gets the job done.
One thing that was surprising to me is that Rufus Peabody is your real name. The sports bettors we've had on this show, like Spanky and Dink, all have really cool names. Now, Rufus Peabody is kind of a cool name, but it actually is your real name.
It is. Yeah. I didn't think ahead to actually use an alias.
Uh-huh. If you had to do it over again.
Would I? No, you know, I like my name too much.
It is a cool name.
And it sounds like an alias, so.
Exactly. Richard, you thought it was an alias, didn't you?
I did. I absolutely did.
Okay. So, on last week's show, a couple weeks ago, Anthony Curtis and Frank B told us they were in New Jersey for the DraftKings huge overlay. You have your own story about that. What was that all about?
I do. Where should I begin?
How about at the beginning?
At the very beginning, I heard about this contest, this sports betting national championship, using air quotes here, because you know you can call the contest whatever you want to call it. They could have called it the world championship if they wanted, but and I heard about the huge overlay. And at the time, I was in Boston, which is where I'm now living with my girlfriend, and who's a doctor, so I have to be there. I don't really love Boston, but but I figured I could take the train down to New York and Jersey City. And, you know, with that overlay, it made sense. So I did. And it took about 48. The registration process was, you know, it wasn't the most organized thing ever. I sent an email to try to register. And 48 hours later, I finally was able to register. So there was, I think, you know, it was the first, it was their first time doing an event like this. They're obviously new in the sports betting space. And I thought it was a great, I like the idea of the event. It's very creative. But I think that there were some growing pains there. So I get down to New Jersey, and I ended up doing quite well. But I'm sure listeners have heard a little bit about what happened.
But probably they didn't know how Rufus Peabody in particular was involved.
So Saturday.
Could you describe what the rules of the event were? You were betting your own money, right?
I was. So there's a $10,000 buy-in, and $5,000 of it is a live bankroll, and the other $5,000 goes to the prize pool. So it was $1 million to the winner. There was a $2.5 million prize pool overall, but I think only 270 people or so registered. So there was a really, really nice overlay. And so my strategy going into this was because the prize pool was so skewed towards the winner. So first place was $1 million, second place was $350,000. I wanted to have a very high variance approach. And so I found some positive EV parlays with parlaying some NFL stuff as well as some golf stuff. And golf is one of my specialties, and ended up hitting on one of these, actually two of these parlays. So which vaulted me from this $5,000 bankroll all the way up to over $40,000 going into the final day. Which put me, I think.
I didn't realize. I thought it was only NFL. So you could bet other sports as well.
Yes, you could bet any other sports
except on Friday and Saturday.
Yes.
On Sunday.
On what? Sunday, you're only allowed to bet NFL, and you were not allowed to place any bets after the kickoff of the late game, which was the Eagles and Saints.
Okay.
And so I was in, going into Sunday, I was in, I think, fourth or fifth place, maybe 10,000 or so behind the leader. And I figured that, you know, I kind of thought about what I would, where I would need to get to win this contest. And I thought I'd probably have to double up twice to get to, based on how many people were at the top and based on, you know, the way the prize pool was structured, I thought that people would be playing pretty aggressively. And so I put all my money on the Patriots to cover -3.5 in the early game, which the Patriots were up, what, like 28 points at the half. It was looking like a very comfortable cover, and it ended up being a very comfortable cover. However, at the end of the game ran long, even though it was a blowout, and there was only about 4.5 minutes between the end of that game and the kickoff of the Eagles-Saints game. And so, unfortunately, my bet was not graded, and funds were not credited to my account in time for the kickoff of the late game. Now, DraftKings had said before that, you know, there might be this narrow window. So to be cognizant of the fact that there's a cash out option. So basically, you could, based on the live market, you'd be able to sort of cash out your position before the game ended. However, that option was not available in the second half because I guess they stopped trading the market entirely, which is something that I hadn't really foreseen. But the other thing was that some people had bets that were graded during the game, some props that technically weren't official yet. So, for example, the person that ended up getting second place had bet Sony Michel over 61.5 rushing yards, which Sony Michel had, I think, 90 rushing yards halfway through the second quarter. And they graded that a win right there, which, I mean.
Did they have to go to the desk to get it graded, or it just was graded automatically?
I think it was automatically graded, it wasn't automatically. I think someone made a judgment that it was leading by enough that that it was okay to grade. So there were other props that were graded during that game as well, during the middle of the game, which was unusual because none of the other games before, none of the other NFL games that weekend had any bets graded during the game. No prop bets were graded during the game. But I think they wanted to help make sure people's funds were available for the late game. But when I asked, you know, I was a little bit upset, of course, that I wasn't able to get my bet in for the late game because at that point, my Patriots bet had won. I doubled up on my bankroll and had a $24,000 lead going into that final game, but was unable to get bets down. But they told me that it would have been illegal for them to grade the bets early, but at the same time, they graded the props early.
Also, it's from what I hear, there were people, there was a desk apparently, and people were able during that 4.5 minutes to go get their bets graded. But my question is, had your bets been graded, what was your plan to bet on the final?
So what was my plan? You know, I'd been thinking about this for a long time, trying to figure out the different situations and where everybody else's bankroll would be. And I thought that I would have that $24,000 lead, but I still wasn't sure because someone could have hit a big parlay further back that I hadn't foreseen because I didn't go through absolutely everybody's, just the people that I thought were actual competition. And so I figured if I needed to double up, the bet I liked the best was the under on the game. So, but given that that wasn't the situation, I thought that everybody would be, all the people chasing would be on, they'd want to be on parlays of some sort and or bets that, you know, they would need to more than double up. So Eagles money line seemed to be where a lot of the money would be. That's what I anticipated. And I figured normally you would think, you know, if you're winning, you want to sort of duplicate what the people behind you are doing. Right. But in this situation, I thought that there would be, I actually thought the opposite was the best move because I figured if the Eagles money line won, someone would hit some ridiculous parlay and get to a really high number and I would have to risk basically, I didn't want to risk everything on some, you know, 5-1 shot or something. The Eagles weren't 5-1, but some big money line. So I decided that I wanted to sort of be aligned with the Saints side. So I figured if the Eagles money line won, I was going to lose. But if I wanted a situation where if the Saints won, I would win. And so I basically tried to figure out the number I thought I needed to get to protect against somebody doubling up against me or hitting. I guess someone could have technically hit the Saints parlayed with something, but or a Saints alternate point spread, which would have paid some plus money. For example, like Saints minus 14.5 probably paid like 2-1 or something. But I figured Saints minus 4, I think, paid in minus 190, and Saints minus 5 was minus 170. So those would have gotten me to the number I thought I needed to get to. So that's kind of where my head was.
And if you had bet that, would that have won it for you?
That would have won. And actually, somehow, miraculously, there was a I actually had a chance to win anyway, despite not having a bet. In that game, if the Saints had won by exactly 9 and they had a field goal, they were up 6, they had a field goal opportunity, a 51-yarder by Will Lutz with like 1.5 minutes or 2 minutes to go that he missed, though. So, unfortunately, I did not win, and I finished third place.
For a lousy $250,000.
Yeah.
Plus your $80,000 bankroll. So, there's more good news than bad, but still, having a shot at $1 million is kind of cool. Plus, you have this great story. All right. We are taping this the day after Super Bowl 53, which some people are calling the Snooze Bowl. Low-scoring game. Now, I know Rufus put out on his Twitter line that he was betting on the Rams minus 2.5.
You mean plus 2.5?
Plus 2.5, yes. So that one didn't cash. Overall, how did you do in the Super Bowl, Rufus?
I did fantastic, actually. It was possibly the best Super Bowl I've ever had. So just because I also put out on Twitter that what I was rooting for was literally the most boring football game anyone has ever watched. So, to be honest, though, even though I won a lot on it, I feel a little bit disappointed because given that the score was 13-3 and it was such a low scoring game, I actually thought that I would have done better. But I had some, you know, the game props didn't do as well as I would have liked. The interception by Brady early on was quite costly to me. And that interception late wasn't good for me either. And I did have some yes bets on players to score touchdowns and the like. But for the most part, my portfolio was very much centered on unders and things not happening. And for the most part, things didn't happen.
Uh-huh. But there was an interception. And so you bet that Brady would not throw an interception.
I bet that Brady would throw a touchdown before an interception. And I bet that there would be under 1.5 interceptions. And I bet that there would be a fumble before an interception at plus money. And I bet that Brady's first pass would be complete.
Well, it was complete, but just not to the right color uniform. Okay. Now, during the game itself, are you a fan? Do you go to a big party? Are you
trading in the middle of the game?
I was not trading in the middle of the game. I did run my model for second halves, but I didn't find any value there. I was at a friend's, actually. He smoked some ribs, made some turkey burgers. It was quite delicious. And I just, you know, stress drinking a little bit, but.
Well, good. All right. So you have a podcast. What is that all about?
So the podcast is called Bet the Process. It's co-host. Well, I co-host it with Jeff Ma, who I'm sure a lot of your listeners know of. He's sort of famous or infamous.
They did a movie about him.
They did a movie about him. This is true. He's the guy from the movie 21, the book Bringing Down the House, famous blackjack player. And so he worked at ESPN as a predictive analytics expert for 2 years. And then I took up the mantle and had the same post for a year and gave some very bad picks on the air. But we were both.
Could that be why you're no longer at ESPN?
Probably. But it was funny. It was the one bad football season I had to that point in terms of the my sort of model's picks, the Massey Peabody model.
Why would you do that, just out of curiosity? Or would you get your money down before giving out the numbers that you? Okay.
So, exactly. Yeah. Yes, I would get my money down, and I give out free NFL picks, but so I have this. Well, I have a collaborator, Cade Massey, who was my former senior thesis advisor at Yale. He's now at Wharton, and he's a brilliant guy. And he and I developed this NFL rating system back in 2010, and we've made adjustments to it since then, and we've started doing college football, it just sort of as a fun exercise would give out our model picks. And we had, we had a losing year this year, but in 2 years ago, but before that, I mean, we're 55% overall over the course of, I think, 7 years, but we give out I post those picks generally on Thursday or Friday. And I'm betting my stuff generally on Monday and Tuesday. And so there's overlap, sometimes there isn't. But the problem with that is that the bets that I'm giving out largely are the ones where there was market resistance, meaning that I bet it, and there's a lot of times I'll bet something, and you know, I'm not the only sharp out there. There's other people that probably see value on similar things, and so if I bet something and other people do, and the line moves, you know, that there may not be value left on that same pick on Thursday. But the ones that I'm posting are generally ones where there was market resistance, which probably means they're not quite as strong.
Do you only put out sides and totals?
Just sides. So
just sides.
The reason I do this is because the NFL is such a big market and it's such a small percentage of what I'm betting, the NFL sides, that I don't think that it's really hurting me that my bottom line that much. And it's allowed me some other opportunities. So, I mean, it's allowed me to brand myself, I guess. I'm not sure to what end, but I've been able to, you know, I've consulted for an NFL team in the past, and I've had other sort of opportunities.
Oh, what was that like? Consulting for an NFL team.
It was fun. The data set they had was quite rich and interesting, and it was a neat little challenge.
But it didn't last. It was a one season thing or something.
It was a few seasons. It was sort of various projects. But I think the frustration with working for a team, and this is why I don't think I'd ever want to sort of do that full time, is that you can do great work, but the likelihood that it actually has any real impact is small, because you have to have the entire organization sort of buying into the sort of philosophy. So,
and they've been slow to do that, but they are changing, right? I mean, you do see more going forward on fourth down. And
you do. You have some organizations that buy in, and I think a lot of organizations sort of have people within them that really embrace analytics. But the problem is there's other people, you know, that may not, who are making the call. So a good example, I once met on a flight someone whose son did analytics stuff for the Yankees. And he would put together reports for Joe Girardi when Joe Girardi was the manager. And, you know, because Brian Cashman, the general manager of the Yankees, you know, had hired this guy and liked him and was a fan of what he was doing. And anyway, he'd put together these reports for Girardi, and Girardi would just throw them in the trash and not even read them. So that's, yeah, I think the one thing about gambling, and I'm sure you gentlemen know this, is that the great thing about it, I mean, there is a lot of luck, but at the same time, you're working for yourself, and the harder you work and the better work you do, the better your bottom line is. You're not relying on anybody else.
Yeah, it is the ultimate meritocracy, right? And so,
if you could pick a team that you think would be most receptive to your kind of work, and so that
whether I bet they'd be in the NBA, not in the NFL.
This
I bet
is true.
Really? Because I didn't think you did NBA, but
no, I don't. But you know, Haralabis Vulgaris, Haralabob on Twitter. Yeah. He's, you know, famous NBA bettor, and he got hired by the Dallas Mavericks to run their analytics department. So I think teams are a little bit more receptive to
Houston
that.
Houston Rockets have been. Is it Daryl Morey? Is that his name?
Yes, sir. Yeah,
that he's supposed to be. But like, I would think. I would think Belichick would listen to you.
I don't know if he'd listen to me per se, but I think, you know, the NFL organization that I think has embraced analytics the most is the Philadelphia Eagles.
Yeah.
So, this season, teams on fourth and two or less in opposing territory, teams went for it 2/3 of the time, which is the most in any year in the NFL. The Rams were, believe it or not, the Rams actually, there were four instances this season where teams kicked field goals from the opposition's 1 yard line. The Rams were responsible for two of them. So for all this, you know, talk of Sean McVay being this amazing innovator, he's actually quite conservative on fourth down, and he actually kicked, he went for it substantially less than 50% of the time in fourth and two or less, whereas the Eagles went for it 15 out of 16 times this season. So,
wow. You know,
they, I think their organization is all on the same page. They have buy-in, you know, at the coaching level and at the front office level as well, and ownership.
There's a question I've had in football that I didn't tell you this was coming, but I wanted to put it by, okay, your team is behind in football by 3 points. It's coming down to the fourth quarter near the 2-minute warning. You still have all three of your timeouts. At 2:15, does it ever make sense to call a timeout to save 15 seconds, as opposed to you might call it at 1:58 and save 40 seconds?
I think it generally does make sense to call it on the, well, outside the 2-minute warning, as long as you're not incentivizing the other team to be able to throw the ball. So the stupidest thing, I think, is when a coach will call a timeout with 2:04 left, because then the other team can pass the ball with no consequence if it's incomplete. It incentivizes the aggressiveness. But, I mean, I see what you're saying, because, yes, you only lose the 15 seconds there. But at the same time, it obviously depends on the down as well, but I think that I don't know. I mean, I feel like
this is unfair to pop at him on the show.
No, I actually think I would call him outside the 2-minute warning if as long as it's not too close to it, though.
Okay, good. We're going to take a commercial break now, and we have lots more questions to ask Rufus Peabody. We'll be right back. The South Point has more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%. This is more than anyone else has. In February, the monthly promotion is a $600,000 Crazy Cupid Money Madness, where simultaneously there will be two casino-wide progressives going. The bigger one must hit between $10,000 and $25,000, and anyone playing when it goes off without being the actual winner gets $25 in free play. The smaller one must hit between $1,000 and $2,500, and is scheduled to be hit about three times a day. Any machine, any time, so long as your player's card is inserted and you have played at least $1 in the previous 60 seconds, you are eligible. On President's Day, they have... Every 3 minutes, they're giving away $100 to someone with their card inserted from 8 o'clock in the morning until midnight. It's a $32,000 giveaway. The class coming up next at the free video poker classes at the South Point is NSU Deuces Wild. NSU is a game that returns slightly over 99.7%. It is slightly positive 24/7 at the South Point. And whenever promotions are going on, you have an overlay with the mailers, the promotions, and the comps. The following week will be the advanced NSU, where it is presumed that you have the basics of NSU down, and it will go over lots of exceptions. Deuces Wild games in particular have many more really, really, really close plays than games based on jacks or better. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the Gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get correction on most of the games. The game of the week is Face Card Frenzy. You may play this game anywhere from 6 coins to 10 coins, where the odds increase as you increase your bet. In this game, full houses and quads, including jacks, queens, and kings, and aces, return a lot more than usual. To make the math work, all pay schedule categories are bumped up, meaning that you need an entirely new strategy to play this game. All right, we are talking with Rufus Peabody about sports.
I want to jump in, and because I know people are going to ask, where it is you release those picks? Is that on your Twitter account, or where do they get released?
So the NFL picks are on the site massey-peabody.com.
Oh, okay. And so. Can you find the podcast there too, or no?
No. The podcast you can find, Bet the Process, anywhere you get your podcasts. That's, I guess, the iTunes Store, SoundCloud, Google Play.
All those places.
All those places.
Can you give like a breakdown of what you're betting in terms of, do you bet mostly sides and totals, or do you bet more props? You mentioned you bet a lot of props on the Super Bowl. How does that break down?
So most of what I'm betting on football is going to be sides and totals and second halves. I do a lot with second halves, but I did get my start on football betting props. It's a smaller market, and I still do bet a ton of props for the Super Bowl, but the Super Bowl now is basically the only day a year I'm doing it, or the only event I'm doing it for, because props are very labor intensive. There's a lot of injury stuff you have to research, and there's a lot of art to it as well. Basically, a lot of problem solving, creative thinking, but it is very labor intensive, and I feel like, my days of sleeping 4 hours a weekend are done at this point.
Now, also, you mentioned that you're normally betting early in the week. And last week, Spanky was saying that there's this delicate balance here of, if you bet too early, you can't get as much down and you move the market. And now you're in competition where you're afraid the other guy might bet first and he moves the market. So how do you negotiate all that? How do you handle that?
It's a tough issue. Spanky's right about that. So for the NFL, it's a bigger market, so I think it's generally easier to bet earlier in the week. College football, I have to wait a little bit to be able to get as much as I want down. But you're right, there is definitely competition, and I think the problem is being a smaller player actually helps. Like the less you're betting, the more advantageous your situation is, because you're able to get enough down early, so you're actually hurting the bigger bettors. So it's tough, but at the same time, there are people that can manipulate the market and things like that, and so it is a bit of a cat and mouse game, though.
Now, Spanky said that for him, it's all about the numbers. And once his bets are made on a good number, his work is done and he almost never watches a game. Is that true for you?
For the most part. I do watch some games. I watch probably more football than other sports. And during the golf majors, I'll watch those. I'm a big golf fan as well. But that's, I don't watch a ton of, I'm not watching any baseball games start to finish these days anymore. And I'm just watching NFL on Sunday because it's, I'm betting second halves too, and it's enjoyable. And I need to talk about it on the podcast as well. So there's that.
Do you do any in-game betting?
I've dabbled a little bit with that. I actually created a model back when I was working at Las Vegas Sports Consultants. I did this sort of on my own time. And when I left there, I actually was betting it in Las Vegas and did quite well with that. But that was also quite labor intensive as well. And I think that there are better, there at the time, there weren't very many good models. And I think I didn't need to do anything that amazing to actually have an edge there. And I think now you are seeing a lot more analytically driven models that people are coming up with. And I think we're going to get to a point where the edge won't be necessarily from having a better math model. It'll be from finding exceptions to that model.
Do you like the bridge jumper bets? Like, no safety has been very popular about those of us who know that that's a good bet, but are not knowledgeable enough to do all the research and find out the other good bets. And so we either win a little or lose a ton. And did you have any money on no safety this year?
I did. I didn't have that much money, though, because the line, because of people like you guys, and because there haven't been any safeties recently, the line didn't get as good as I kind of hoped it would. I remember there was a stretch, I'm sure you all remember if you've been betting the no safety.
Expensively, I remember.
Yeah, there was that stretch where there was three safeties in 4 years, I believe it was. And
yeah, 4 out of 7 and also 4 out of 25 or something.
Yeah, yeah. So it. After that, you were seeing some like -600s and -550s on the no, but I think it's been what, 3 or 4 years now without a safety. So,
but now the other one that we had talked about a lot was no overtime, which there have been a lot of overtimes. How good did that number get?
So that I bet that at -800 and -900, and I think my true price was only maybe -1260. So it's not a huge edge, but it's an edge. And I think the fact that there were two overtime games in championship weekend was something that sort of made that line better. But for a long time there hadn't been a Super Bowl that went to overtime until that Patriots Falcons Super Bowl 2 years ago.
Yeah, the good old 28-3 game. I think they remember that in Boston. You mentioned golf. Is there money to be made golf betting?
There is, yes.
Do they take much action at golf?
Most places don't, no.
He gave us a look of, don't ask me any more questions about that. Now, on the NFL, how do you get your data? Do you buy your data? Do you create it yourself? What do you do?
So I buy data and I scrape data myself. So
tell me about the scraping process.
So the scraping process is I wrote code to basically take the play-by-play feed and extract the play-by-play feed, and then I parse it out. And that's used for live betting stuff and betting second halves. So the real-time stuff. Whereas the data I buy is basically the same thing with a little bit of stuff that isn't in the NFL game books, which is the play-by-play. But the advantage to that is that it's already parsed out nicely in nice CSV tables. And if I'm paying $800 a year for it, it's
a trivial cost.
Exactly.
Now, in baseball, are there good sources in baseball?
Baseball is great because all the data is available for free. You can, and baseball has a very rich data set. They have the pitch FX data, which you can see the release point and sort of coordinates of a pitcher's pitch. You can see the velocity on it at the when it was released, the velocity when it was caught, the X where it crosses the plate, XYZ coordinates, I guess. And so it's, or maybe just XY. I'm confusing myself now, but
the plate is 12 inches long or 18 inches long, whatever. So any place along that Z axis would be, it doesn't have to be in the entire Z axis, does it? just any place in there?
Yeah.
The front edge or the back edge? Isn't that the rule?
Yeah, I do wonder where they're measuring. Like, is it when it crosses the front part of the plate or the back part of the plate?
Yeah.
And you also wonder why they bother to have umpires anymore when they have the data, whether it was a strike or not, right?
Yeah, it's a very good point. And I think that a lot of us would be happy to sort of see these robo-umps. Because there is, I mean, and there are biases in umpiring. So, for example, when you have a lefty pitcher facing a lefty batter, the strike zone is sort of moved to the outside. So a pitch that's on the inside corner is generally not called, like right where it should be a strike, isn't called a strike often. And just off the plate outside is called a strike more. So there are these biases that are sort of persistent. But that data is, I mean, that data can be accessed for free by anybody. And you can scrape it and you can play with it, and it's great.
What kind of stuff do you have on your Twitter feed?
Ooh. So I would say, you know, you had Spanky on last week, and Spanky, yes. Spanky's Twitter feed is largely about who's a bookmaker and who's a dressmaker, right?
Right. Right. Who threw him out this week?
I would say my Twitter feed, you know, is most active during the football season, and it's largely analytics driven and about betting. I've never really done I wonder if you actually looked back through my posts and analyzed it, what percentage are different things.
So, process. What is your process in getting ready to bet Super Bowl?
To bet the Super Bowl. So betting the Super Bowl is quite a process. I have a lot of code I've written over the years. And so most years I'm just kind of going through this and refining and making sure. Well, trying to remember what I was thinking when I wrote it years ago also. Sometimes it feels like, you know, I'm reading a different language, even though I wrote it myself. But the process of sort of handicapping these is sort of differs for game props and player props. Game props are things like no safety, for example, which is pretty formulaic. And, you know, will there be a score in the first 5.5 minutes of the game? Will there be a score in the last 2 minutes of the first half? Will the team that scores first wins? Will there be a lead change in the fourth quarter? Those are all props that I can just figure out. They're basically derivative props. They're derivatives of the point spread and the game total, which makes them pretty simple. And so, you know, each year I kind of want to update it because they're regression based. And as you have more data, you know, you want to add that in.
But huge rule changes too. The data from 10 years ago on those kind of things might be useless today.
That's a good point. So specifically, will there be a two-point conversion? Will there be a missed extra point? Things like that are definitely going to be affected by the rule changes. So for the fact that you have extra points that are now 33 yards, the fact that touchbacks go out to the 25, those have definitely impacted.
Some touchbacks go out to the 25. Some go to the 20.
It's true. Touchbacks off of a kickoff, I should say. So you know, one example is the defensive or special teams touchdown. That makes the defensive or special teams touchdown less likely because there's more touchbacks on kickoffs. You have fewer kickoff returns. So that used to be, I remember 10 years ago, maybe that was on average, the no was maybe minus 190, minus 200. Now it's substantially higher, as it should be. I think there were only 16 special teams touchdowns all season this year. If I remember correctly, it was a very, very low number. You have a lot more defensive touchdowns. But the player prop process is a little bit different and a little more involved. And that's sort of, there's a little more art and creative thinking there. So that's, I kind of take a top down approach on a lot of it. So I forecast number of plays each team will run, which is, you know, based on, I have a number for each team's offense and defense, which is, it factors in, that season's data, you know, properly decaying it a prior from previous years, because sometimes previous years, you know, still have some predictive value, and then controlling for opponent and regressing to the mean. And so I start with plays, and then I figure out what percentage of those plays will the quarterback drop back looking to pass, and then what percentage of those will he be sacked on, and what percentage will he scramble, and then the rest are going to be pass attempts. And from there, I try to figure out what percentage of passes are going to be targeting different positions in different locations. So deep versus short. And from there, I'm able to build out like the number of completions, And it sort of it proceeds that way. And then I figure out player stuff sort of by figuring out their relative contribution to the team. So, for example, I had Julian Edelman getting 28% of the Patriots' targets. You know, and a guy like Dwayne Allen, who spends a lot of time on the field but never catches the ball, like 0.1%. So you have, and based off of that, you can generate projections. And then I do the same thing with projecting touchdowns. So what percentage of the team's touchdowns will this player get? And so, and then based on these projections, I can figure out the proper distributions and compare my numbers to the prop lines that are offered.
Now, Bill Belichick has a reputation for changing everything around from week to week, more than other coaches do. Is it safe to bet into that?
Is it safe? It's never safe with Belichick. But you're right, he does. He seems to really surprise the opponent as much as he can, do something they're unprepared for. And so you're right. I think, you know, 2 years ago, James White had like 13 catches in the Super Bowl against the Falcons. And a lot of that was the fact that they were playing from behind and he's their pass catching back. But he was actually the one guy I probably had an over on in that Super Bowl, which was great. But, you know, this year he had nothing. So I think you're right. I do think there is a little bit more variance with some of these Patriots players.
So safe wasn't the right word. Is it a smart bet to
bet on Patriots or against to bet on Patriots
on props
games at all?
Of how many yards Tom Brady will have, or who will catch the most, or which running back will score how many yards they'll run, because you really had little idea whether it was going to go to Sony Michel or Whitehead or White Burkhead or White, sorry, because any week it could be any of them.
So there may be more variance, but you can still come up with a projection and project out that variance and what, you know, what the likelihood that Burkhead gets, you know, 4% of the rushes relative to 25% or whatever. And so run some simulations based on that and kind of have this distribution. So I think, you know, the thing is everybody's working with the same data. So I think in a way the Patriots might be better because it's a little bit more challenging. And so, you know, if something was easy, everybody would be able to do it. I think the Rams are a good example for this season. Cooper Kupp got hurt in week 11, but since then they've had the same wide receivers healthy every game. So it's fairly, I don't want to say fairly simple. It is fairly simple, I guess, to project out the Rams wide receivers this year, and there weren't the same edges there.
One of the things that comes up a lot in all different forms of professional gambling is that sort of figuring out how to get the edge is only half the job, and trying to actually get the money bet is a whole nother kettle of fish. And so you were out to Las Vegas for the Super Bowl to try to go out and get the money down. Did you feel like you got down as much as you thought you could? Did that go successfully? I mean, obviously you said you won money, but how did you feel about that, your ability to get down the money on the Super Bowl that you wanted?
Well, you know, I wish I was one of these people that could bet six figures on something. That would be nice, but because you read about these all the time, right? On Twitter, you know, MGM took a $300,000 bet on this team. But I do think...
Yeah, that's Floyd Mayweather or somebody
exactly.
They know is a multi-million dollar loser.
I think Vegas overall is pretty good, though. I wish the limits were better, but at least most places in Vegas that aren't William Hill are willing to take limits from me, even though, like the Westgate, for example, they know who I am. They know that I've, you know,
they know you're not an idiot.
That they move hard on my action, but they take my bets. And so, and I respect that. And I think Vegas, I think they're probably the best out here, but I think that even, MGM, Caesars, like they'll take limit bets. I mean, limits may not be what I want them to be, but I respect that. Whereas in you know, places in New Jersey, and sort of that European style of bookmaking is catering just to recreational bettors and saying, I mean, for them, their goal isn't to make the best number or anything. It's to, they want to take the most amount from recreational bettors and cut the sharps as much as possible. So I personally believe very strongly in sort of, I guess I'll call it the pinnacle model, which is taking bets from sharps and using that information to your advantage. And I kind of have this crusade, I think, to kind of prove that this model can work, and this bookmaking model can work, because it's probably a little more difficult.
For Pinnacle and Chris.
It did. And I don't think there's anybody in the US doing this right now. And I think that's a niche, I should say. Someone corrected me once on that. It's a niche that I hope will be filled. And
that must be a Yale thing. I still say niche.
But it's something that I hope we'll see.
So you got down as much as you thought you would, or there were no big surprises either one way or the other in terms of your Super Bowl action.
Right. There weren't. A few years ago, I went up to William Hill. I was still able to bet at William Hill at that point, and their opening prop numbers had just come out, and it was like Christmas morning. I was like, oh my God, there's so much value. I get up to the window, and they're like, Mr. Peabody, we can't take your action anymore. And I was like, but I know Nick Bogdanovich, like, and it was just the worst timing too, because, you know, if I had known ahead of time, I could have possibly planned for that, but I didn't. So there weren't any surprises like that this year. So that was good.
How would you legally plan for that? Let's assume that you wanted to use me as your runner, who any sports book will take my action. Without running afoul of any of the laws, how would that have gone down?
It wouldn't have.
Actually, as long as you have a piece of the action, it's not. My understanding is that is not.
So if you put up $500,000 and I put $5,000 into the pool, and then we're betting that pool money, isn't that legal?
My understanding is that is not illegal, as long as you have a piece of it.
I don't know, but I wouldn't want to take that risk.
Okay, fair enough. Now.
And if one of our listeners knows, they can correct me on that. So
yeah, that was my understanding. We've had guests on here who've made just a bundle of money betting horses rather than sports. Did you ever consider that?
I never did. No, I just, for me, it was being a sports bettor kind of came out of my love of sports and the numbers side of sports in particular. It wasn't something it wasn't a career path I had planned on. However, I also do know people that have made money with horse betting. I think it's harder because there is
not made money.
You can make a lot more money, I think,
yeah,
right? Because you can scale it.
Bigger.
Well,
yeah.
you don't have the racetracks don't want to kick you out like the sports books do, because it's a pari-mutuel market generally, and they want that liquidity, right?
For the most part, but there are a lot that have that sort of casino mentality that if it's good for you, it must be bad for us. But yeah, you're right. You're not winning the track's money. So
you're winning other people's money.
Right,
but I mean, it's my understanding that a lot of people get these sort of big horse bettors are able to get rebates, right? So rather than having to win, you know, beat that 17% track takeout, they're only having to beat, say, like, you know, 5 or 6% or something. Is that right?
Yep. Yeah.
Must be nice.
Yeah.
Must be nice. You went to Yale. Parents were really hoping you'd go into something else, I'm pretty sure. How did the family situation go when you chose the lifestyle that you did?
Well, I think my parents' real concern after college was, and I think my dad communicated this to me a few times, was that I don't take a dead-end job. Make sure that there's, you know, what is this sort of path going to be? And to be honest, like, I didn't know. And so, you know, I think they just didn't want me to get trapped and go down this road that led to nowhere. And so I think what they knew, they were very supportive of what I did because they knew how much it meant to me, and they knew that it was me. It was very much who I was. And so they were very supportive of that. And I think when I was able to, you know, I took a job making $25,000 a year for Las Vegas Sports Consultants. So that wasn't,
that sounds like a dead end job.
It does, doesn't it? And, you know, if I hadn't met the right people, or, you know, I mean, you know, I might have been a very different thing.
It sounds like a great stepping stone. You're right. Short term, it's not great, but it's a stepping stone, right? I mean,
but I loved it. And for me, it was never about the money. I'm very fortunate right now that I can do something that I really enjoy and make really great money. But I think part of the reason that that's happened is because I didn't make decisions based on the money. It just happened. And so I feel very, very blessed. And my parents are very happy.
Well, good. You mentioned you have a girlfriend. I don't know when you last changed girlfriends, but how does doing what you do affect that part of your life?
So that's a really good question. And what, yeah, you caught me off guard a little bit, but I actually spent most of the last year, I guess, ending in from September of 2017 to September of 2018, traveling the world. I did this program called Remote Year and was able to live in a different city each month with about 50 other people that were entrepreneurs, remote workers, or freelancers. And so I think doing what I do allows me a lot of flexibility. I don't have to be in one place, and I'm able to, I think it's good because it means I can move to Boston and live with my girlfriend, who's a resident at Mass General Hospital right now. And she has 2.5 years left to do that. And, you know, while Boston might not be my number one choice overall, like, it allows me to, you know, I imagine if I had a job somewhere else, like, it would make it more difficult. And so I think the flexibility is good. I think the problem is sometimes, work-life balance can be difficult, especially when you don't have set hours. And so
for you, I mean, what about her? Right.
Well,
I mean, resident.
Yeah. I would not wish that on my worst enemy. It's her work schedule is brutal.
Yeah. But she's okay with you being a professional gambler.
She's okay. I mean, I'm more of an investor than a gambler, if you think about it. Like, I have the edge, but
I've tried that line too.
I think some people are a little more scared of that than others, but I feel like when people get to know me and who I am, they see that, you know, I'm not some degenerate gambler. You know.
So one of the reasons I've said many times, one of the reasons I married my wife. I mean, she got it right away that what I did was, you know, a job that it, you know, that I was not going to go broke, that I was not a degenerate, and it was work.
And if someone doesn't get you, then that's not the person you want to be with.
Right. Yep. Absolutely.
My most recent thing in that area was Bonnie got it, but her relatives didn't.
Ooh.
Bonnie was 70-ish when we, 70 actually when we got married, and her heirs were possibly counting the inheritance before I came along. The idea of a professional gambler, they saw all of their inheritance going out the window. They were more than moderately opposed to this, but over time they figured it's not what they originally thought. So
it's gotten you this far, right?
Well, that's what the turkey said in mid-November. What everything is great. What possibly could go wrong? very good. Thank you, Rufus Peabody. This has been enjoyable.
We should mention you can find Rufus on Twitter at Rufus Peabody.
At Rufus Peabody, my real name.
Yeah, right.
At myrealname.com. Very good. Thank you very much. Thank you, Richard. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.